The following presentation was recorded live by HAudio.com.
Okay, so hi everyone. This is the introduction. We're starting at the beginning. And the first couple classes we're going to do is just a general introduction to all Jewish history. I often do this as a separate presentation called Back to the Future, and it's really the most basic information. You know, I basically teach history, but I hate using the term history because I even use the term history and people freak out because history is a subject. You know, that means there's names, there's dates, things to memorize. There's going to be an exam. One thing I learned is if you turn something into a subject, it immediately takes all the fun out of learning it, which is probably why my favorite quote from Mark Twain is, I never let my schooling interfere with my education. Okay, that which we learn in this world and we use, the longer you're out of school, the more you see this, that the stuff we really use in this life has often very little to do with what we learned in school itself. And that's certainly not the reason to learn history. And we Jews, by the way, are obsessed with learning history. But before we look at the Jewish reason to learn history, just step back a minute. The reason to learn history in general was best said by the Spanish-American writer-philosopher George Santayana, who died in the 1950s, but he said probably the most famous quote about history, those who don't learn from the past are destined to repeat it. You all heard the quote? It's an obvious point. That presidents and prime ministers come and go, nations and empires, they rise and fall, but human nature is basically human nature. And we Jews, we do the same stupid, well, not we Jews, we human beings, we do the same stupid things over and over again. I think the way it was said best was Elie Wiesel when he said, if there's one thing we learn from history, it's we don't learn from history. At least we learn one thing. I actually saw a cute quote in a classroom in England. It said, history doesn't repeat itself, it's just that people don't listen. So in general, we have this idea we need to learn from the past as human beings. But as Jews, there's a much more specific reason to learn from history. And we're actually commanded to learn from history. It says in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 7, Zechor Yemot Olam, remember the days of old. Ask your elders and they'll tell you. It's almost a commandment to remember the past in Judaism. So we Jews, actually, of all the people in history, have a unique relationship with history. There is a historian by the name of Yosef Haim Yerushalmi, and he wrote a book called Zachor, which means remember. And in it, he says in the introduction, it's based on a series of lectures he gave a number of years ago about the unique Jewish relationship to history. And in it, he says, if Herodotus was the father of history, the father of meaning in history were the Jews. Jewish people are not only arguably the first people to record history, although according to Yerushalmi, he's quoting the Greek historian Herodotus, who lived about 2,500 years ago, as being the first Westerner to record history. But we were the first people to see that there's meaning in history. And as to why we Jews are so obsessed with learning history, we have to step back and understand what is the most important idea we gave the world. Besides gilt, bangles, junk bonds, leverage buyouts, Einstein, Marx, Freud, 22% of all the Nobel Prizes since 1900, 25% of the Forbes 400 list, all these great pieces of trivia, what's the most important idea the Jewish people gave the world? What do you guys think? Yeah, God, brought to you by the Jewish people. We didn't invent God, obviously. God invented us. But we brought the idea of God into human consciousness. And the concept of God has huge implications for everything in this world. I mean, we understand about God. Well, actually, we understand nothing about God because we're finite and he's infinite. But we do understand, and the most basic way I can say it is God is the creator, sustainer, and supervisor of the universe. That means that everything, from the cosmic to the quantum, is under the constant supervision and control and direction of an infinite being, God. Simply put, it means that history is a control process leading to a destination. We're in a story. Now, if someone told me, by the way, I'm in a story, my first question would be, it's sort of like when you go to a bookstore to buy a book. You know, assuming people still read books, but when I go to a bookstore, I know it's a rare thing. When I go to a bookstore to buy a book, the first thing I look at is the cover. What's the book about? Who's the author? I read the back. I read the reviews. What else the author wrote? If someone told me I was in a story, my first question would be first and foremost, I am? Really? What's the plot? And, you know, how long does the story take? How many pages is it? And where are we in the story? Okay, you buy a book, you start at the beginning, but obviously we're not in the beginning of our story. How long does it take? Where are we? And the most interesting question of all is, are we merely scripted into the plot by God? Or do we interact with it? Do we affect the outcome? So this introduction, the first couple classes, is really dealing with these huge sort of overarching points. You know, what's the purpose of creation? Why are we here as human beings? What's the Jewish people's role in the story? You know, where are we in our story? And do we impact the story, or are we just scripted in and have no free will in the process? So that's what we're going to cover in the first couple classes. So to begin at the beginning, we have to start with in the beginning. Now, Jewish time Like the world today uses a Christian calendar, which obviously begins with the supposed birth date of Jesus. Jewish time does not begin. We Jews are much older than that. Our calendar begins much before that. So you guys know when Jewish time begins? From what event? A lot of people say creation, which is not true. Sorry? Not Abraham. And it's not the Big Bang. Okay? If the Big Bang is day one, in the beginning God created, boom, this energy and the world is created. If that's day one, okay, Jewish time doesn't begin with day one. Right. It begins on day six. Now, we, by the way, have a great teacher here in Eshet Torah, Dr. Gerald Schroeder, double PhD, nuclear physics and oceanography from MIT, author of four different books on science and Torah. He wrote a great book called Genesis and the Big Bang. And he shows how you beautifully can synthesize the science with the Torah, how you fit those billions of years into the first few days of creation. That's a whole separate class. We're not going to go into it. I'm dealing not with the science, but with the history. But time begins on the sixth day, which is Friday. Now, what happened on Friday in the creation story? Anyone know what happened? Friday, creation? Right. Human beings, Adam and Eve. What do we learn from that? Well, let's use the analogy of a movie director. A director doesn't wake up and call his cameraman on his cell phone and say, meet me downstairs in 15 minutes, we're going to shoot a major motion picture. It's years to actually, a preparation before you actually start filming a movie. You got the scripting, the casting, sceneries, like lighting, special effects, makeup. Remember, like Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and all the men and women are the players. So God spends a huge amount of time setting the stage, putting the physical world in order, getting everything set up. Now, when does the director say action with the clapboard and start filming? When who comes on the set? The actors. So too, we don't start filming our story. We don't start. We don't start keeping time. Time as we know it, that is, a day, you know, is the earth revolving on its axis once, until human beings show up. What do we learn from that point? If we don't start filming until human beings show up, what's the lesson?
That we're the focus.
Excellent. The focus of creation is us. The camera's on us, so to speak. For us, the world was created. Okay, the focus of creation is us. Now let's go back to our movie analogy. The director spent a huge amount of time preparing to film. The actor comes on the set, the big guy. Action, then the actor turns to the director and says, Mr. Director, line, script. No actor like Brad Pitt or someone who's getting paid millions of dollars for a movie shows up on the set without knowing his lines. The focus of creation might be us. For us, the world was created. But what's the purpose? Why are we here? What are our lines? You guys realize this is the biggest question there is? This is the number one question in reality. I ask this question to thousands of people. Most people give me a blank stare. It's amazing. Most important question in existence, and people often go through their whole lives without answering it. A lot of observant Jews will say something like, we're here to serve God. There is an idea in Judaism. We even say in Hebrew, Ivdu et Hashem besimcha, serve the Lord with joy. But it doesn't mean that God is like sitting at a table in a restaurant and you're the waiter coming to bring him a steak. Because what we do understand about God is that he's infinite. Now, infinity is not an idea we can really understand. But infinity, it means God is a being that wasn't born, doesn't die, always is, has no parts, doesn't eat, doesn't sleep, doesn't change, doesn't think. Anything we ascribe to the physical world is not relevant to God in infinity. Which means, simply put, you can't do anything for God. I mean, to use a more mundane analogy, you know, who's the richest person in the world? Bill Gates. If he's having financial problems, you know, poor guy's down to his last 50 billion, you can't help him. I can't help him. Okay? No one can. God is infinitely wealthy. You can't do anything for God. So it's a completely sort of lopsided relationship here. Another example would be like a newborn infant and its parent. What can a newborn baby do for its parent? It smiles. The parents get all excited. Very little, actually. Very little. What can we do for God? Nothing. But God can and wants to do anything and everything for us. Judaism teaches, you ready for this? The purpose of creation is pleasure. Now, by the way, we have a class in Eshet Torah. It's a very important class. It's arguably the most fundamental class, not only every Jew, but every human being needs to know. It's called the Five Levels of Pleasure. So I'm not going to do the whole class because that's a whole separate class. I'm going to touch on some points, but I highly recommend, you know, checking that information out. It's so basic. We have to first define our terms, pleasure versus comfort. Okay? The opposite of pain is not pleasure, it's comfort. It's no pain, that's comfort. Think about it. Like we say in sports, your coach says to you, no pain, no gain. what's truly pleasurable can actually be quite uncomfortable and require a lot of work. As a matter of fact, it's a pretty obvious connection. The more you put into something, the more you get out of it. Okay, the harder you work, the more meaningful it is. Which is why getting a PhD, I think, is a little higher level pleasure than when you first learned, you know, toilet training. It required a little more work. You get a lot more out of it. Raising a child is a lot more work, you know, than eating an ice cream sundae. And it's certainly a lot more pleasure if you do it successfully. So that's what Judaism teaches, that the purpose of creation is pleasure, not comfort. Comfort is like sitting on the beach on vacation in the Caribbean with that drink, you know, the pineapple drink with the umbrella in it, watching the waves. It's fun for a week in the winter. No one wants to spend their whole life doing that. You go out of your mind. Pleasure is something very, very different. Rabbi Weinberg, the Rosh Hashiva of Eshet Torah, when he teaches the class, he often uses as an example. He tells the guys in the class, ask your parents, mom, dad, what's your biggest pleasure in this world? What will they say? You, my son or daughter, whatever. Then ask them, mom, dad, what's your biggest pain in the world? What will they say? You. It's not a coincidence. It's probably where Roseanne Barr once said, the comedian, now that I have teenagers, I realize why some mammals eat their young. The more work, the more you put in, the more you get out. Judaism teaches there's different levels of pleasure. We're not going to go through all of them. Lowest level pleasure is physical pleasure. Love is higher. Now, by the way, just like on the Richter scale with earthquakes, second level pleasure is not twice as good as a first level pleasure. It's exponentially much greater. And so on. Love is higher than just physical pleasure. We're going to skip the other ones because it's not our class. But what's fifth class, highest level, nothing comes close at all to it, pleasure? God. Right. God. Not Coke, is it? God, is it? It's fifth class pleasure. It's the real thing, as they say. Forget the Coke commercials. It's the real thing. In Kabbalah, we call it dvekut or dvekus. Okay? It means like dabek, to connect to. Connecting to God. All of the love, relationships, children you could raise, amazing things you'd accomplish in this world don't equal one nanosecond of being in the presence of the infinite. And the Garden of Eden, by the way, which we always see as this medieval painting thing, you know, with Adam and Eve with the fig leaf strategically placed in the snake, the tree, and the apple, they get it all wrong. The Garden of Eden is not some ideal, so much a physical state, although it is an ideal place in terms of no distractions, everything's taken care of. It's an ideal physical and spiritual place where we have nothing to distract us. And trust me, we have a lot of stuff distracting us nowadays in the world. There's all the things that we have to deal with in life, which only become a bigger and bigger list as you get older. When you're younger, you think you have a lot of things to deal with. When you have a house and a mortgage and wife and kids and okay. And then, by the way, see, then you have all of the technology that distracts us. Everything that's beeping and ringing and flashing. And it's amazing how people's attention span, I've noticed over the years, has gone down and down and down and down and down until people, I think they said like 15, 20 years ago, the average American's attention span was 45 minutes. I think it's now closer to 45 seconds. But the Garden of Eden is synonymous with the ideal physical, spiritual state. And we're free from all the things that distract us to do what our soul really, really wants to do, which is what? Fifth class pleasure? Hang out with God. Okay? Or to say it in 1960s slang, depending on how old you are, you'll appreciate it. The purpose of creation is to hang out in the garden and groove on the Shekhinah. Hang out with God's infinite presence. And it should have been the most short, straightforward story possible. God puts us in a world where our basic software operating package of our soul is to want to have a relationship with Him, highest class pleasure. We're free from everything that distracts us, and we just hang out in the garden and build a relationship with God. Straightforward. But it's not so simple. Think about it. If according to the pain is the pleasure, different level, right? And highest level pleasure is relationship with God. What's the hardest thing to build and maintain in this world? Relationship with God. It's not just to sit in the room and meditate. You put on the orange robe. Nothing wrong with meditating if you want to do that. But it's a lifetime of struggle to build or maintain a relationship with God. Something that is a little bit like it, but nothing close, is marriage. Like we've all seen too many romantic movies. And, you know, after the trials and tribulations, they get together and live happily ever after. Now, you can definitely be happily married. But anyone who thinks that marriage, once you get married, that's it, has never been married. It's a huge amount of work to build and maintain a relationship with another human being. That's what marriage is about. So too, humanity basically found it too hard to do. I mean, think about it. It's an obvious point. It's easy to say, but hard to do. God is everywhere, and the universe exists within God, not to get too Kabbalistic. But He's not standing in front of you like I am. You can't take Him out to Starbucks for a cup of coffee. People basically said, you know what? It's extremely difficult to do this relationship with God thing and maintain it, to keep God consciousness. But God put all these really cool things in the world that I can see that are right in front of me. Sun, the moon, stars, trees, water, mountains, you name it. I'll worship those as a way of indirectly showing respect to God. But what happened? After a number of generations, people basically forgot about God. Remember the Wizard of Oz? Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. They focused on, they didn't see the being behind the curtain. They focused on what was right in front of them. What happened? People forgot about God and ended up worshiping the forces in nature. What do we call that? Paganism, idolatry, polytheism in Hebrew, Avodah Zorah. By the way, almost all New Age religions today fall into that category. The whole relationship is blown, which is a disaster, because the whole purpose of creation is about having a relationship with God. The first several thousand years from Adam onward is the story of the ultimate divorce in human history, of humanity blowing their relationship with the Creator. Boom, 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 descending, descending. And by the way, you can't do anything for God. You can't hurt God either. Like, people ignoring God doesn't hurt God. Can't help God, can't hurt God. But to deny God is to do more damage than you can do any physical damage to yourself. It's to totally negate the purpose of creation, to blow it. It's the whole purpose of the universe is to have a relationship with God. So humanity goes into a huge decline in the middle of this decline. Now, this is not a Bible class, so we're not going into the details of the stories. You can spend hours discussing the issues involved in every one of these stories in the book of Genesis. But in the middle, we have that famous flood story, Noah's Ark. We all know the story. Most of us learned it as little kids and haven't really looked at it too seriously since then. But it's a very profound story, Noah's Ark. What's the plot? If you abuse it, you lose it. You abuse the world, you lose the world. So God decides very heavy stuff. To wipe out the world, sparing only Noah. Hopefully, he's hoping that Noah will elevate, repopulate the world with his descendants who do have relationship with him. Get humanity back on track. Does it work? Uh-uh. Noah's only capable of saving himself but not getting the world back on track. The world continues to decline until it gets to the Tower of Babel story. Tower of Babel story, which is humanity uniting for all the wrong reasons. Today we call it the General Assembly of the United Nations. Back then it was the Tower of Babel, one of my least favorite organizations in the world, whatever. What are they united to do in the Tower of Babel? What's humanity united to do in the Tower of Babel story? Right, rebel against God. That's arguably worse. To ignore someone is one thing. To actually start up with them is another. So it looks like game over. We bottomed out. Now imagine God sitting up in heaven, so to speak, saying, okay, got to nuke the universe, we'll try again. Like, take my whiteboard, I wipe the board clean. Does it? But along comes one human being and he changes everything. Who's the one human being who changes everything? Abraham. This is the ultimate power of one story. Abraham, over 3,700 years ago, comes out of Ur Kasdim. Where's Ur Kasdim today? We all know about this. Yeah, it's Iraq. Ambrose Bierce, who was a writer during the Civil War, has a great line. He says, war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. So now, Americans are pretty geographically challenged, but someone told me so are English people. You live on an island, you know, what do you know about the rest of the world? They know where France is. Most Americans, Mexico they have trouble finding. They have no trouble finding Iraq and Afghanistan. So out of Iraq, almost 4,000 years ago, comes one man, Abraham. And this one man, Abraham, okay, he's really a superhero. I hold he's the greatest human being who ever lived, not just the greatest Jew who ever lived. And Abraham is great for two reasons. A, in a world that has totally lost connection with God, Abraham is this free-thinking super genius. He's able to think outside the box. The whole world's thinking pagan. He's able to think above and beyond that and come to the realization there's one infinite creator of the universe, God. That's an amazing thing. Can you imagine being the only person in the world to come up with an idea which no one else could comprehend or accept? I don't think any of us have the chutzpah to whisper to our best friends. And that's the real greatness of Abraham. He's also not just a great thinker, he's an intellectual and idealist. What does that mean, intellectual and idealist? You know, most politicians will say one thing before they're elected and then do the opposite afterwards. A true idealist and an intellectual practices what he preaches, regardless of the consequences. Abraham is exactly that. He says, I choose to live and if necessary to die for the reality of God. Now remember, you can't live for God, you can't die for God. You can't do anything for God. But Abraham recognizes that without relationship with God, we are doomed. So he dedicates himself, being the intellectual and idealist that he is, to a unique mission. That's what chosen people means, by the way. Every Jew has got to understand this idea and be able to explain it. What does chosen people mean? You know, the non-Jewish world has asked this very little nasty rhyme about the Jews for about 100 years. It goes like this. How odd of God to choose the Jews. You know, like, it's kind of nasty, you know, like, they're saying, like, pick someone people like. That, of course, don't appreciate that it's precisely because of what we chose to do. That people don't like us, but that's a very profound topic, dealing with anti-Semitism, which we'll hopefully get to later. But how odd of God to choose the Jews. You know what our answer back has been? It wasn't so odd the Jews chose God. Abraham is the first Jew by choice, by the way. He's the first convert, proto-Jew. Abraham says to God, God, so to speak, I choose you. I choose to dedicate my life and the life of my children and their children's children's children to having a relationship with you and to teaching the world by example about how to have a relationship with you. And God says back to Abraham, so to speak, you're choosing me? Then I choose you, Abraham, back. You and your descendants, us, the Jewish people, what are we chosen for? It's not privilege. It's a big privilege to be Jewish, but we're not chosen for privilege. We're chosen for responsibility. What's the responsibility? In Hebrew, the term is tikkun olam. Tikkun olam. What does tikkun olam translate to? Fix the world. How's that for a cause? Just a little bigger than save the whales. It's the ultimate cause in human history of being the nation whose job it is to teach humanity about reality, about God, and to create a working model of a society that has a relationship with God, and to teach values and spirituality to the world, and to elevate not just ourselves, but the whole world to relationship with God, to get the world back to the purpose of creation. Okay? The ultimate cause in human history. Reconnect humanity with reality. So from Abraham onward, we have a plot rewrite. Our initial plot didn't work. You know, sometimes in a movie, something, the actor dies, or, you know, the plot's not going well, the people who are paying for the production don't like the plot of the movie, you have to change it. So God, so to speak, has to do a rewrite. So what's our new plot? Our new plot is, our original plot was humanity hangs out in the garden building relationship with God. Our new plot is humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. This is the story not just of Jewish history, but of all of human history. All of humanity is in the story, but the Jewish people, we have a unique role to play in it. Now, I know that sounds a little bit egocentric. Someone once said to me, by the way, they heard me say this, they said, Rabbi, like, how many people are in the world? I said, over 6 billion, like 6.2, who knows, 6.3, what's a billion, what's 100 million between friends? They said, how many Jews are in the world? I said, 12.5 million. He said, come on, that's the plot? You guys are a quarter of 1% of the world's population? From Abraham onward, we've understood one important idea, that reality is not a popularity contest. Okay? There's a great line, by the way, in 1984. You guys read the book 1984, George Orwell? One of the great... you have it on you. Unbelievable. By the way, if you're reading the book and you find the line, please underline. I want to see it again. I know it's in there. I'll tell you right now. It's the hero is Winston Smith. You know, it's the few anti... I remember reading it before 1984. But there, in the story, it's fascinating. You know, Winston Smith, one of the last free-thinking people in this horrible, like, you know, society where they change reality and brainwash you and watch you through your television. They really do this, by the way. Go put Spybot on your computer and you'll see what they know about you from what websites you surf. But the hero Winston Smith, Big Brother, is the controlling force. They get him and they want to break him. And, you know, out of his mouth comes a line that you know Abraham said. It's one of the great lines of Western literature, but it's such an amazing line in terms of reality. And you know Abraham said it. He said there are truths and there are untruths. And just because you're in a minority of one doesn't make you wrong. That is Abraham. That's a perfect Abraham line. I don't care if everyone in the world believes opposite. I know what reality is. And I'm willing to die for that if necessary. Again, you can't live for God, you can't die for God. But that's reality. It's more important than life itself. So it sounds like a kind of weird concept, but that's the way it is. Humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. All of humanity is in the story. We have a unique role to play. There's a British lord who lived over 200 years ago. His name is Lord Bolingbroke. Bolingbroke has a great quote, one of my favorite quotes about history. He said, "History is philosophy with examples." Fantastic idea, by the way. You know, people can spout all kinds of theories about reality, but if when you run them through the laboratory of human interaction, you see what, like a great example, nothing to do with Judaism, is 100 years ago, a communist and a capitalist could have had a great debate about which economic system was destined to dominate the world, because communism believed in economic determinism. Human nature combined with economic realities will move the world to an ideal communist socialist state. In theory, they could have argued, you know, for hours and not come to a conclusion. We jump ahead 100 years and we can see that while capitalism might not be perfect, communism is a disastrous failure. History is philosophy with examples. So I always tell my students, anything I say, no matter how weird and funky it sounds, it can be tested by looking at reality. Look at past history, look at current events, and you'll see that it makes 100% sense. So let me give you a couple of examples to illustrate this concept about, you know, history, reality. If you look at what's going on in the world, a couple of points to illustrate this. I'm saying illustrate specifically the concept that humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way is a reality that if you stand back and look at it, you'll see. And before we look at this example, there's only one other thing I want to say, which is such a basic piece of information. Every one of us has like a sort of software operating package in our brain of how we process things. We're also taught to look at history in a certain way. Now, I didn't go to elementary school when you guys did. I went much earlier. I went before multiculturalism. When I was in elementary school, they still had no problem teaching the history of the dead white guys of Europe. You know, that what was truly meaningful, the real plot of human history was the rise and fall of empires. The big civilizations, ancient Egypt, the Greeks, the Romans, the British Empire, the Cold War, the big battles, the big empires, the big rulers. The reality is, Judaism says, that the real plot of history is much, much more subtle. It runs through everything. But it's not the big battles, the big empires. It's something much more subtle. But if you start to be sensitive, sometimes, you know, the most sensitive things require like a real, you know, the things that are very subtle require a real sensitivity to be able to detect them. It's like listening to a soft piece of music versus someone playing electric guitar really loud. It's not hard to hear electric guitar, but it's really hard to hear the flute solo. So the real plot is much more subtle. This is the real plot. It runs through everything. And if you can just, let's say, delete the original software package and start putting like new Jewish software in your brain, or a better analogy might be, look at the world through Jewish lenses, that this is really the plot. Humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. You will see that you can actually, that it makes sense, that all the seemingly disconnected events in human history start to fit together. There's a pattern. And you can see where things are going even. And it does fit. And everything is interconnected. So as weird as it sounds, by stepping back and using just a little different model and putting it into the events of human history, you'll see how things are connected. Let's go back to this idea of humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. How do we see it? Two examples. One example is I call it the infantry example. Now, I've lived in Israel for a very long time. I served in the Israeli army. I was in a combat infantry unit in Southern Command of the Israeli army. And when we used to go out on foot patrol, okay, which is never a fun thing to do anyway, especially if you're in a scary place like Gaza or something like that. You go out two by two, spread apart, and there's one guy in the front of the unit. What's he called? In infantry speak, the point man. The point man is a position of tremendous responsibility. Why? He's scouting things out. But it's also a position of tremendous danger. Chances are, if there is an ambush to be walked into or a mine to be stepped on, he's the first guy that's going to get it. Now, when we chose for ourselves this unique responsibility, we became the point nation of history. Initially, guys, all of humanity, Adam and Eve, are the physical personification of all of humanity. Everyone comes from them spiritually. When humanity fumbled the ball, to use an American football analogy, when they dropped the whole plot, this whole story we talked about here, what happened? We picked it up, beginning with Abraham, and we ran with the ball out in front. We are the point nation of history. So we have a unique responsibility, like the point man in the unit, but it's also a position of tremendous danger. This is the one true cause, not the excuse, cause of anti-Semitism. All excuses that we kidnap Christian babies, use their blood to bake matzah, poison wells, bring the Black Death to Europe, or in league with the devil, control the U.S. economy, the world's economy, the stock market, trigger earthquakes in Southeast Asia to make tsunamis that drown Indonesia aside. This is the one true cause of anti-Semitism. We are always out in front. And when evil comes into the world, if there's a Jew in the neighborhood, he will always be the first target. You can test this. It's not an accident. The most evil people in the world are the biggest anti-Semites. It doesn't work with Mao Zedong so well because there was no Jews living in China. Okay, so that's number one. The other way you see it, guys, is even more obvious. I mean, think about it. Our original movie had a very small cast, Adam and Eve. But now, like movies, if you think any movie today, the structure of a movie is sort of like a pyramid. At the top of the pyramid, the top of the pyramid gets the most camera time. Those personalities that have the camera, they get the most money and the most camera time. Who are those people? The lead actors. Below them, you have the supporting actors. Still major people in the plot, but less significant. Then you have the bit parts. Okay? Then you have the extras, or the walk-ons. So this is all of humanity. Everyone is in the story. But we, the Jewish people, are at the top of the pyramid. We are the lead actors, so to speak. Which doesn't mean we get the most money or the most reward or the most good press. But it does mean we definitely get the most camera time. Just like in a movie, the camera focuses more on the lead actors than anyone else. So too, the world's eye will focus more on the Jewish people than anyone else. Now, I'm saying this in a negative way, but we think of movies and lead actors as a positive thing. I'm thinking of it as a negative. You know who said it best? The newspaper columnist Charles Krauthammer. It's something if you think about it, it makes perfect sense, but we're so used to it, it's really supernatural, but we take it for granted. Krauthammer said it best. Jews is news. Now, since we know that good news is no news, meaning we only hear about bad news, whenever a Jew is involved in something bad, it makes much bigger headlines. And, of course, whenever Israel is involved in something. And the double standard is absolutely outrageous. If you stand back and look at it, you either have to think the whole world is taking drugs or they're all getting bribed from someone to say things that make no sense whatsoever. The fact that, you know, I was ragging on the United Nations General Assembly, which is a very destructive organization in my opinion, but the fact that two-thirds of all UN resolutions passed since 1990 have condemned Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East with free press, free speech, and a free market economy, surrounded by 22 feudal, semi-feudal, totalitarian Arab states, no one cares what they do. It's unbelievable. Right now, as we speak, the UN, like Human Rights Commission, and the General Assembly is debating a motion to condemn Israel for cutting off, for limiting the supply of heavy diesel for the power plant in Gaza because it's what? Collective punishment. The 8,000 missiles and mortar rounds that have been fired from Gaza into Israel, which is an open act of war, doesn't even appear in the motion. This is nuts. That the EU could vote in 2004 when asked to pick from 15 countries, including such paragons of democracy and free press and free speech as North Korea and Iran, which country in the world most endangers peace and stability? Who came in number one? 60% of Europeans voted for what? Israel. By the way, who came in number two? The United States. The only people who like America are Israelis. Anyway, come on. Is this weird or is this weird? That all these countries, like the French, are telling us how to behave? You know, say in New York, the Statue of Liberty had both hands up when it left Paris? Come on, guys. Is this hypocrisy? Is this a double standard? This is outrageous, but this is the way it has to be. We will never be treated like anyone else because even subconsciously the world is aware there's two standards. There's a standard for Jews and there's a standard for everyone else. And you know how you see it in the most basic way? The world divides itself up in many different ways. North, south, developed, underdeveloped, first world, third world, white world, not white world, whatever. The funniest way dividing the world up is Jew and Gentile. Like it's 50-50? We're good. The only thing funnier than that is Gentiles. Jews never use the term Jew and Gentile. Gentiles use it all the time. But you know who really said it best? There's an old Hebrew National commercial. You know Hebrew National, the meat? Not even kosher, really. They have this commercial with Uncle Sam standing under this very scary-looking sky, like it's going to really rain, like thunderheads. You know? And the announcer says, the United States Department of Agriculture allows you to add this many additives, food coloring, and animal parts into your hot dogs. And Uncle Sam nods his head. He's smiling. Then he does his head the other way, like shaking, no, no. And he looks up at heaven, and the announcer says, Hebrew National, we have to answer to a higher authority. So take out Hebrew National and put in Hebrew Nation, you have one of the great truisms of being Jewish. We will never be treated like anyone else because even subconsciously the world is aware there's two standards. There's Jew and non-Jew. And as much as this drives us crazy, that's the way it has to be. The way I say it, guys, is being Jewish, it might not be comfortable, but then again, pleasure isn't comfort, but it's always meaningful. Because we have this unique role to play and this unique responsibility, the world will always, even subconsciously, remind us you Jews are different. I'm telling you guys, start to look at the world through these lenses and these analogies, and you'll see that it fits in. It's all kind of supernatural and weird, but if what I'm saying is true, this is the pattern you're going to see over and over again. Jews is news. Okay, so now we understand. Quick review. Purpose of creation is relationship with God. Humanity blows it. Along comes Abraham and chooses for himself and for us this unique responsibility. Bring humanity back to relationship with God. That's our new plot. Humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. But now, let's look at a little timeline here. How long does our story take? I mean, no story goes on forever. So the Talmud says in several places, including in Sanhedrin, probably the biggest discussion is in Sanhedrin, page 97a, Tractate Sanhedrin. It says, for 6,000 years, the world was created. Now, it doesn't mean from the creation of the universe to the end of the universe is 6,000 years. That makes no sense. It means from when we start keeping our Jewish time, which is day 6 of creation, okay, Adam, Eve, human beings, to the end of normal history is a maximum of 6,000 years. Now, guys, what else is 6 in our Jewish cycle besides the number of times you go to the buffet table before you finally go for dessert? What else is 6 in the Jewish cycle? The sixth point of the Star of David is 6 points, but 6 days of creation. Like it says in the Psalms, Ki elef shanim enech yomet Moshe avar. Like 1,000 years in your lifetime, God, are like one day that goes by. Every day of the week is equivalent to 1,000 years, we're being told. And just like we have, Jewish weeks begin on what day? Sunday. The Monday morning blues begin on Sunday. It's one of the things I miss about, you know, Israel has no real weekend. And that and Costco. You know, there's a few things. America's a great place for shopping. Use those giant things of peanut butter. It'd be great to have, you know. So Jewish weeks begin on Sunday. And what time of the day they begin? Sunrise or sunset. Not the song, the day. Right. Saturday night, the stars come out. We enter what's called, it's not called Sunday, Monday. In Hebrew, it's called Yom Rishon, first day, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, first day, second day, third day. We're being told that from 0 to 999 is Sunday. From 1,000 to 1,999 is Monday. So we're going to have 6,000 years maximum of normal history. History as we know it. But what happens when you get to Friday night at sunset? That's the sunset of the sixth day. What do you come to? The seventh day, which is? Shabbat. So too, we're told we have a seventh millennia, the 7,000th year, the seventh that century, which is called Olam. It's not the 7,000th year. It's actually from six. As soon as you get to 6,001, you're already in the seventh. 6,000 is already the seventh millennia, right? When you get to the year 2000, the 21st century, same thing. We have Olam Haba. How do we translate Olam Haba? The world to come. The world to come. Now, by the way, the world to come is not where you go when you're dead. That's Olam HaNishamot. And Judaism believes, yeah, the soul world. The body is just a vessel. The soul is what goes on after the body's gone. So you get put in this world for a short period of time. You get a chance to use your free will to interact. If you get it right, whatever, you don't have to come back again. To quote the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young in Deja Vu, we've all been here before. Okay, you can even go to, there's even guys who do past life regression, find out who you were in a previous life, not the topic of our class. That's the Olam HaNishamot, the soul world. Olam Haba is the world to come. But that's when the world goes back to the ideal state it was in the beginning, before the degeneration happens. If you've heard of concepts in Judaism, resurrection of the dead and final judgment, you guys heard of these ideas? These are ideas that take place in Olam Haba. Okay, we're not going to talk about that. That's past our time frame. That's post-history as we know it. We're also told, by the way, that before we hit the year 6000, before we enter that seventh millennia, we have a transitional period called the Messianic Era. The Messianic Era. Okay? Now, the Messiah is a very Jewish concept. Christians took the concept and changed it, and, you know, made a totally non-Jewish concept. But we originated the idea. The Messiah is a human being, and we'll do a whole class on it later, on Judaism, Christianity, Jewish concept of the Messiah. But the Messiah is a human being. Specific job description he has, we're not going to go into now. But his job, he's not the end of history. He's a catalyst. He prepares the Jewish people and the whole world to enter the final phase. Okay? And we're told he has to come by the year 6000. And someone wants to ask, of course, what if the Messiah doesn't come by the year 6000? So the question that someone always wants to ask, I always give the same answer, ask for your money back. Now, first of all, what ifs in the future are not really legitimate questions because they're speculating on a purely theological level but not really dealing with reality. And by the way, I do a whole presentation called Edge of History, Prophecy and the End of Days, and it's pretty clear from that presentation, from Jewish sources and current events, that not only is the Messiah on the way, but he's coming sooner than we think. We'll talk about that a little even today. Okay, so 6,000 is our maximum. Okay. Again, Messianic Era, transitional period before Olam Haba, has to happen before. The Messiah has to come and have finished his job before the year 6,000. Let's do a little bit of math here. So we got 6,000 is the max. What's the Jewish year now? 5,768. Okay. So let's see where we are. When we hit 5,000, what day of the week are we in?
Friday.
Right, Friday, day 6. 5,500? Is not halfway through the daylight hours, it's halfway through the hours of the day because the Jewish days begin at night. 5,750 is 3/4 of the way through the day. 5,768, where are we? Very late Friday afternoon. This is like when you're in a Jewish, you know, an observant Jewish family's house. The wife is screaming at the husband, get in the shower, it's going to be Shabbos in 15 minutes. And by the way, very important point. Just like, you know, Murphy's laws, like the chance of the bread falling butter side down and directly proportional to the price of the carpet, those important laws about reality. There's a Murphy's Law of Shabbat. No matter when you start preparing for Shabbat, even if it's the Motzi Shabbos, the Saturday night after Shabbat just went out, a half hour before candle lighting, everyone is running around like chickens with their head cut off. Because as it gets close to the end, everything speeds up and gets very intense. And even that, guys, is an analogy for what happens at the end of days. As you get close to the end, things really start moving and they get very intense. But we'll save that. Okay, so 5,768 is where we are. Late Friday afternoon, let's do our math. 6,000 minus 5,768 is 232 years, and that is a maximum. Now, just like if you know how Shabbat works, in Jerusalem the siren goes off before Shabbat 40 minutes early. Everywhere else it's like 18 minutes. Okay, just like you don't wait till sunset, so too, this is a maximum. It can end much quicker. Messiah can come. The whole story can end a lot sooner, and trust me, guys, it definitely will. Okay, we'll talk about that later. Okay, let's just look at one other thing here. We have 232 years left till the deadline. By the way, this whole timeline of 6,000 years is further subdivided. The Talmud in Sanhedrin 97a subdivides this 6,000 years into three 2,000-year periods, and it gives each of these 2,000-year periods a specific title, which is telling you what the theme of the period is, what the overall theme is. The first 2,000 years, guys, goes from when our story started, from Adam until Abraham, which is a period of 2,000 years, okay, is called Tohu Uvohu. Tohu Uvohu means what? It's borrowed from the second sentence in Genesis. In the beginning, God created, formless and void. There, in the Bible, it's talking about the nothingness. Nothingness is not space. Nothingness is an impossible idea to understand. The nothingness that exists before God creates anything. Here, it's talking about the fact that, like we said before, from Adam to Abraham, no relationship with God. The spiritual void. You had a question?
Yeah, doesn't it mean became formless?
I don't want to go into the linguistics of what it's referring to in the Bible in terms of creation story. But nothingness is also something it's not we can't imagine. That's a separate time. I'm just borrowing the title to show you that in the first 2,000 years, which corresponds to that spiritual decline when humanity, the flood story, which it bottoms out at the Tower of Babel, but it ends with the appearance of Abraham, there, no relationship with God. The next 2,000 years, which goes from Abraham until the year 240 CE, the Common Era, less than 2,000 years ago, is that 2,000-year period is called Torah. And that covers, think about it, it goes from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all that stuff. The patriarchs going into Egypt, the slavery in Egypt, 210 years, Exodus story, Mount Sinai, getting the Torah, Joshua entering the land, conquering and settling the land, Judges, First Temple period, Judges 440 years, 410 years, First Temple period, 70-year Babylonian exile, 420-year period, all the way past the destruction of the Second Temple, till around the 3rd century, 240 CE, which corresponds to the writing of the Mishnah, the Oral Law, which we'll get to later, and more or less the appearance of Christianity as a major world religion. That is Torah. That's the story of us, the Jewish people, creating a unique nation in the land of Israel. Jews are the hardware, Torah is the software, creating a unique nation that's a model. And the last 2,000 years is called Messiah. And Messiah goes from 240 CE until the year 6,000, which is, of course, a maximum of 232 years in the future. What's the plot of that last 2,000 years? That's when humanity collectively returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. That's when humanity collectively returns to God. Now, what's amazing, guys, is if you lay this model as laid out by the Talmud over the reality of human history, you see that it actually fits beautifully. Think about it. Like I said before, from the birth of Adam to Abraham, the world has no relationship with God. But from the birth of Abraham till the birth of Christianity, which corresponds to that middle 2,000-year period called Torah, we will, in fact, exist alone in the world as the only people believing in one God, and the whole world's going to think we're nuts and is trying to kill us. The only people, we don't appreciate that today, because today we live in a world where our neighbors are, you know, Christians or Muslims, and they're basically monotheists who are offshoot religions of Judaism. But back then, forget it. That's when Hanukkah took place, which we'll get to later. That's the pagan Greeks trying to destroy not the Jews, not us, physically, but Judaism. Only when we rebelled because we wouldn't give up our Judaism, they had gone after us physically. But it's history's first religious ideological war. It takes place in this period of time where we're the only monotheists in the world. The last 2,000 years, which we haven't reached the end of, is Messiah. And think about it, guys. In the last a little less than 1,800 years, we've had the greatest moral, spiritual transformation in human history. Think about it. Today, there are billions of people in the world who basically believe in a, who used to be a bunch of amoral pagans, who now believe in a worldview that's essentially Jewish. Who are these billions of people we're talking about? Christians and Muslims. I mean, think about it. Any Christian or Muslim will tell you, okay, there's one God. Okay, the Christian one's got a few parts. We're not going to go into that now. He created the world. He gave one standard of morality to humanity. He gave the Jewish people the Torah at Mount Sinai. Christians and Muslims will say, they will admit that there was initially a relationship there. The last part is the problem. Then they both will say that we blew it and they got chosen instead. That's a different problem. That's a different problem and a different presentation. But this is the greatest spiritual transformation in human history. And by the way, guys, if we were to make a graph of humanity's return to God, it wouldn't be a straight up line from the bottom like this. If I were to graph the progress of humanity through history and returning to God, it would look more like this. What graph looks like that? It's an economic graph. What financial graph looks sort of like that one? Wall Street since 1930. Think about it. Imagine after the great crash in 1929. Imagine your great-grandparents invested $10,000. Imagine 80 years ago. How much was $10,000 80 years ago? It's a lot of money. Imagine your great-grandparents invested 80 years ago $10,000, okay, into the stock market. How much money would you have today? You would be unbelievably wealthy. So too we see that the growth has been absolutely tremendous, but there have definitely been big ups and downs. 87 there was a down, in 2000, high-tech crash, But the overall picture is one of tremendous growth. Obviously, a Holocaust is a big down. A return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel in recent history is a big up. Even Christianity and Islam, their creation, as much as we've had problems and have problems, is still viewed by the rabbis as a move forward of getting humanity out of paganism. So we understand that we have a model laid out. We have a plot laid out. Okay? And we've seen now that everything sort of fits in. Until now, it looks pretty good. And we're very, very close to the end of our story. So just to sum it all up, remember, purpose of creation, relationship with God, humanity blows it. Along comes Abraham and chooses for himself and for us, that's chosen people, a unique responsibility to get back to relationship with God, get back to the garden, so to speak. Our new plot of history is humanity returns to God with the Jewish people leading the way. We have 6,000 years to do that in maximum. We are now very, very close to the end of the story. All the patterns that we've laid out so far, when you lay the theoretical patterns that are put forth by the Torah over the reality of human history, you see they all fit beautifully. And we're now extremely close to the end of our story with a maximum of 232 years left till history as we know it will come to an end.
You have been listening to HAudio.com. For information about our online services, visit our website. To contact one of our representatives, write to hashaudio@hash.com. Shalom from Jerusalem.